I also have another note later on. Demerzel equals Radar O'Reilly.
wait a minute. Okay, now you're gonna have to explain this one to me. How is Demerzel Radar O'Reilly?
Hello and welcome to Season 3 of Star's End, a podcast dedicated to Isaac Asimov's classic sci-fi series, Foundation.
We're reading Asimov's fiction this season, but we'll keep you informed on show news for Apple TV's Season 2.
While we all wait for that, the three of us will be here with our own inimitable take on Asimov's universe. Please join us. You'll be glad you did.
Welcome to episode 2 of season 3 of the Star's End podcast. Today we're going to continue our reading of Prelude to Foundation, the first prequel. We're going to take Harry Seldon, who's been on the run, up to Streeling University. He's going to go outside for a walk, get lost, get rescued. Along the way, we're going to meet some new characters, and we're going to find out more about the development of psychohistory and how that is taking place. Guys, I assume you did the reading, did your homework. I know you. So, any preliminary thoughts on this chapter, or what, or maybe some things left over from last week that we didn't get to that you were dying to talk about before we move on?
I don't remember any. I can't think of any unfinished.
I thought you were going to say you don't remember anything we talked about last week at all. So non-memorable.
I can either confirm or deny that.
Yeah. Okay. Dan, anything any loose ends you want to tie up here before we go on?
No loose ends. My ends are tied. Let's forge ahead.
Should we do a little story recap?
And then let's do that.
All right. So in the first section of the story, Harry and Cheddar Hummon arrive at Streeling University. And Hummon continues to make arrangements for Harry, including promising him a credit tile, which I really wish somebody would give me a credit tile. I'd appreciate that. And again, very generous, using a lot of his time, but he's going to leave. And we have a conversation about the independence of the universities on Trantor, which is something that we seem to have multiple times in this chapter, where Cheddar describes to Harry the reason why he's safe at the university, which is that the Emperor does not dare to interfere with the independence of the universities. I can't help but think that the first of several times in this chapter, Asimov is giving us his kind of pet views on the way things should be. You know, that universities should be off limits to everybody, and they should be bastions of intellectual and academic freedom. Even in the Emperor, in the Empire of the far future. In any case, Harry wakes up the next morning, and we are introduced to Doris Venable, who's going to be a major character. Harry is surprised by the radio holographic doorbell, where he sees an image of Doris come through the doorbell. There's a description. I always like to get these descriptions of Harry looking at women. I guess it's a pet peeve of mine. He gives her a kind of a good stare and says she's not amazingly beautiful, but was quite pleasant to look at. This being helped by full lips that seem to have a slight humorous curl to them. Doris actually notices him staring at her and makes fun of him, although he is not embarrassed. And she tells him that he should be able to teach at the university because there's a shortage of mathematicians. I'll just leave that with you, Joseph. Shortage.
Isn't there always?
isn't there always? We can never have enough mathematicians. And in the case of Doris, you know, we never have enough historians. So, anyway, they go out and have breakfast. They discuss history a little bit. Harry begins to get the idea that he should study history in order to further develop psychohistory, that he's going to need to know everything about history. They have yet another conversation about the independence of the university. Doris tells him that the bureaucracy on Trantor needs well-trained people, and they want to have their own universities, and the Trantorian universities have great reputations, and yet again, another reason why the Emperor dare not interfere with the independence of the university. They have a little chat about over-specialization, which again, I can't help thinking is another Asimov, a little bugbear, because as we know, Asimov was the generalist of all generalists, tried to get his finger in every subject he could. And I think that he was a little worried about over-specialization in academia, where people in different fields were not talking to each other. And he thought that there would be a lot more progress if people would cross their lines of specialization. But that's just, I think, a pet peeve of his that he wanted to get into the book. Then we switch to Cleon talking to Demerzel after yet another formal state dinner. We find out that Cleon has a wife that he doesn't really spend much time with now that there's an heir. And they talk about Selden. They spar a little bit. They're impressed, as I am, by Harry's twisting skills, because, duh, of course they are. Who's not impressed by that? And they have a conversation about the independence of universities, because Demerzel tells Cleon that they can't get to Harry because he's being protected by the university. You know, to me, I think Asimov made his point about university independence at this point. And of course, they conclude by saying that they might have to kill Harry to keep him out of the wrong hands, by which they mean the mayor of Y, a character that we will continue to talk about and eventually meet. We go back to see Harry 6 weeks later. He's been studying. He took a library skills course with Doors. He flirts with her. He's going to teach her to play tennis. She's actually pretty good almost immediately, which is sort of Chekhov's tennis lessons, I think. That Asimov had a point in bringing that up, that she's immediately very athletic. He's frustrated because his study of history is not going very well. And, you know, he's worried that he has to know about all of history in order to develop psychohistory. And there's a lot of history in this empire that's been going on for 20,000 years. And in fact, Dor's area of specialization as a historian is Trantor before that, what they call Royal Trantor, before it became Imperial Trantor. And then Harry is just worried that he needs to know everything about everything. He runs into another professor, a psychology professor called Lee Sung Randa, who gives him the idea to go upstairs and go outside to get away from everything. And again, we encounter yet another attempt by Asimov to sort of update his story and get it away from everybody being a white man. And I'm going to tip my hand and say, I found this unbelievably awkward. He describes Randa as having a sallow complexion and narrow eyes because he's an Easterner, what they call an Easterner. There are also Southerners who are black-skinned people with curly hair, and Westerners who I guess they don't need to be described because they're normal, I guess. For some reason, there are no Northerners, although, you know, why he didn't describe them as being sort of blonde-haired and blue-eyed, I don't know, but, you know, maybe.
That was my question. My question was, what happened to the Scandinavians?
Yeah, I don't know, maybe Asimov didn't like them. I don't know, but I hard to get through that little passage without feeling very awkward.
It was cringy. It was the worst for me was later on when, you know, he's suspecting Randa of having tricked him. He makes some kind of reference to like those short, devious Easterners.
Oh my God.
It was just terrible. So,
but they're good at math. He makes a point of saying they're good at math.
Yeah. So, like, I got the feeling that when, like, this was not written in the 50s. This was written.
Oh, this was in 1988.
In the 88. So he could have done better in the 88. Oh. I feel like he was showing how progressive he thought he was by saying, by the way, there's not all white guys here. And, you know, those Asians, they really are great at math and good for them. but from the late 80s, this has not aged well, to say the least.
No, not at all. So, yeah, I mean, Yeah, I don't want to dwell on it, but it's there. And it, you know, again, yeah. I think it just goes to the awkwardness of Asimov's attempt to update the story. He did not do the best job.
Well, yeah, you might even think this is a step. And I realize we're in the middle of the summary.
That's fine.
You might even think this is a step backwards, because in one of the Empire novels, didn't he say something to the effect that everyone was basically a uniform shade of pale tan or something?
Maybe.
Everything would merge into sort of a uniform humanity, and so. In some sense, this could be a move backward.
Yeah, I find it hard to believe that in 20,000 years that would be those would be the divisions of humanity that would remain. I mean, I know people have talked about how if we start colonizing planets, and yet it's still very difficult to travel, mm-hmm. that we can do some of these like generational ships, you might actually wind up with colonies that are separated from each other for thousands of years, and you might get kind of different evolutionary drift between mm-hmm. humans from different planets. And I find it hard to believe that these divisions would be able to persist for that long. Well, whatever. We all agree. It was cringy. It was awkward. Whatever. An interesting thing, though, is that in all this chat, what Randa is telling him is that the meteorologists are having a very difficult time predicting the weather, which is certainly an analogy to Harry's difficulties with psychohistory, the same sort of massive chaotic system that is notoriously sensitive to initial conditions. So Harry is interested in that. He tells Doris he wants to go outside with Jennar Leggan, the meteorologist, and Doris doesn't think too much of it. She's too busy to go with him, so he goes alone. He starts out on a bad foot by not dressing warmly enough. It's cold outside. He goes up and he meets Clausia, the intern, the student. Leggan, it turns out, is extremely arrogant and dismissive of Harry. He thought Harry might be able to help him, but when he finds out that he can, he's just like, just go do whatever you want to do. And Harry talks to Clausia about the vegetation that grows on the outside of the domes of Trantor, which grows because there's an accumulation of dirt and dust, and then trees and things are growing. And he wants to see some trees. So he goes off to find some trees. Clausia has to go back to the experimenters. Harry sees some kind of an aircraft flying around and begins to get very paranoid that it's someone who's after him. And he runs through various conspiracies involving just about everyone. Clausia, Leggan, Doors. He's worried that anybody might be in on the conspiracy. He panics. He's lost. He's cold and tired. And in the next scene, we just see Doors being very worried about him. And Doors is going around talking to Leggan. She talks to Clausia. They vary between not really worried about it and pretty dismissive and arrogant. In the case of Leggan, she has to push. She has the idea of checking seismographs. This is all takes a long time, by the way. This is a lot of pages and pages of this. We meet Rogan Banastra, the seismologist. He's a little bit dismissive, but he does see evidence of footsteps outside. They go back up and they find Harry pretty quickly, not that far from the door, and they bring him back down. And the doctor, I thought this was kind of funny, the doctor is kind of excited to see the case of exposure, because you never see that on Trantor, and he's pretty psyched to get a chance to treat that. Harry survives without too much damage. Leggan apologizes, though he does it in quite an arrogant way. Doris continues to threaten him and his career. She asks him about this aircraft that Harry saw, and he claims he doesn't know anything, but then says, oh yeah, there he did see what's called a jet down, which I guess is some sort of like vertical takeoff and landing type craft where it has its jets pointed down so it can hover and it can move slowly. And he thinks it probably would have come from another meteorological station nearby. He does mention Y again. We keep hearing that name, Y. The Emperor has mentioned it, Demerzel and he have talked about it. And again, it could be from Y. So we'll put a pin in Y, because we're going to come back to that in a little while, or in future episodes. And so we've got kind of a bridge episode between the initial introduction of the story, where we meet Harry and we meet Cheddar and we meet Cleon and we meet Demerzel. We have met one more major character in Doors here, but otherwise this all felt very much to me like a little bit of throat clearing before the actual story starts. And we got a few kind of background ideas that are going to come back and come up to us later on. So that's the story. We didn't get a lot of Cleon and Demerzel. or Cheddar Hummin, a little bit of Cheddar Hummin, not too much. They kind of exited from the story. And this was really about, this is about Harry and thinking about psychohistory and trying to, he's thinking about history. He was thinking about meteorology. He's trying to develop the ideas how we can get to a working version of psychohistory. So what did you guys think?
So it is, to me, it's an odd arc within the novel, because it doesn't seem to go anywhere. I mean, it goes to the surface, it comes back down, but like narratively, it doesn't really go anywhere. Right. And so I'd like to just kind of talk to start out of why would Asimov write this? He's giving us a lot of space on this trip, the field trip to check out the weather and getting lost up there. And I'm not sure, as if I was a heavy-headed editor, I might have told him to just cut this whole thing from the novel, because it's not obvious why it should be there. So I'm curious, what is it doing here? And what is it not doing?
Well, I think one of the things that it's not doing, and because I thought that the connection with meteorology was going to be just rife with mathematical interest. Mm-hmm. Right? Because the things are so closely analogous in terms of what he's trying to do and then what weather forecasters are try to do, that I thought that this was going to be a seminal chunk of the growth of psychohistory. But it seemed to mostly be world building. Right. Just like, I mean, there were big chunks of the last bit that we read that was, all about the underside of Trantor. And now he wants to take us up and give us a better idea of what the top side looks like. I mean, certainly this is a very different perception or a very different image of what the upper side of Trantor would have been that I had from reading Foundation. So I just feel like he's trying to fill in some details here, at least with the trip to upper side.
Yeah, I have to agree with you there. And I think, Dan, your point about editing, I mean, by 1988, I don't think anybody was daring to edit Asimov. You had gotten Asimov to agree to write a new Foundation book. You were not going to quibble over.
Probably correct.
And part of it might be just our choice in what we chose to read for the week. We made some arbitrary choices about where to stop.
Yeah.
Because immediately after this, just as a little bit of a preview, he's going to start going around Trantor and meeting different people in different areas. So there's more or less, there's going to be some more action in the next few chapters. I do feel like, though, the point that I made before about, repeatedly talking about the independence of universities, looking at the arrogance of various professors, nothing, present company accepted, of course, but I felt like he was shooting at some clay pigeons of his, that he wanted to make some points about people and things, and he took the opportunity to take some shots. It felt that way to me.
Yeah, he certainly does have a lot to say about universities in this section. I think he'll have even more to say about them, if I remember correctly, in Forward the Foundation, where we actually get Harry working at the university for decades, and that's the novel.
Getting mugged repeatedly.
That too. So there's that, and I think you're right in that. Like, the independence of universities is kind of a hobby horse, which I don't disagree with. There is, I think to a degree, even though it's kind of a red herring, it is framed as a kind of exciting action sequence that is at least supposed to gin up some tension. Like, what was that really an Imperial ship coming after him? Was it a ship of why? Is someone after him? And it's, after this sequence is over, they do get on the move again. And so, maybe it's sort of a way of bringing in some themes he wants to bring in while also trying to arouse the reader's suspicion, keep the reader guessing, heighten the tension, something like that.
Yeah, I mean, I'm very interested in where this potentially could go, because otherwise I've read up to exactly where we're stopping today. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I mean, there are all sorts of those questions, and then there's what's up with doors. I don't know I have an idea that something is up with doors just from talking to you guys for the last few months. I don't know how apparent it would have been on a different first read.
Well, I apologize for spoiling all that.
It's not a big deal. I mean, I'm not saying I'm not enjoying it. I'm just curious how it would be reading different.
Well, I can tell you that in reading it for the first time and not knowing the outcome, certainly ask a lot of the same questions, like what is going on with Doors? Just as with Cheddar, you find Cheddar dropping his entire life to support Harry. We're going to find Doors doing the same thing. She's just going to drop everything to go with Harry and becomes a very important character.
She dropped everything already to sit at his bedside.
Yeah, I mean, you know, without giving away too much, I mean, I think in the whole Foundation series, not counting the sequels, but in Foundation and Empire and Second Foundation, there wasn't much of a love interest. There was one relationship between the Darryls, but even Arcadia didn't have, you know, she had a father, but not a mother. You know, Torrin and the original Torrin and Baited was the only real relationship we had. Here we have a love interest for Harry. It's certainly going to get more intense the more time they spend together. And she's going to be a major character in both the journey around Trantor that we're about to take, and eventually also in the development of psychohistory. But yeah, so thinking about reading it for the first time, yeah, I had a lot of the same questions. You wonder about Doris, like what is the story? Why does she just drop everything? Is it just because Cheddar asked her to? I mean, not to spoil too much, but there's a collection of people in this story who do an awful lot of things just because Cheddar asked them to, which is, it's kind of an ongoing theme here. You know, Cheddar is calling in favors and people are doing things and doing, you know, things out of character because Cheddar asked them. But ultimately, Harry is the one who does the most. I mean, Cheddar, after knowing Harry for about 15 minutes, says, you got to travel, you know, you've got to get out of here. You got to drop all plans to go home. You've got to develop psychohistory. And Harry just goes, yeah, you're right. I got to do all those things. So Cheddar is a very influential, very persuasive person.
Is one note that I have, I'm looking at my notes from chapter 17, reference to both Cheddar and Doors guessing thoughts.
What does that mean, Joseph? Guessing thoughts, right.
Guessing thoughts.
Harry does mention that he feels like he's already felt like Cheddar could read his thoughts, and now he wonders whether Doors can too.
Right.
And he also occasionally, with both of them, says, he made some kind of decision, not knowing why, or against his better judgment. So
not
very suspicious. Torrin. Yeah. Very suspicious stuff.
Very suspicious.
Yeah. I also have another note later on. Demerzel equals Radar O'Reilly.
wait a minute. Okay. Now you're gonna have to explain this one to me. How is Demerzel Radar O'Reilly?
Well, I can actually find the passage, I think.
Remember why Radar got the name Radar.
Yeah, that's it. Quote, Demerzel always appeared at once when Cleon called, whether he hovered constantly in earshot at the door or he drew close because of the instinct of subservience somehow alerted him to a possible call in a few minutes. He did appear at that, Cleon thought idly, was the most... He did appear and that, Cleon thought idly, was the most important thing.
Right. I mean, if you think about it, especially in the early, like the first couple of seasons of MASH, one of the big shticks they had was a conversation between Colonel Blake and Radar, in which Colonel Blake would be issuing a series of instructions to Radar, and Radar would be half a sentence ahead of him the whole time. And it was almost like Henry was repeating back what Radar was saying instead of Radar repeating back what Henry was saying. Mm-hmm. And they would do that, you know, basically once a show. They would have Radar telling the future, basically.
Yep.
So there you go. We've done a MASH reference. I think that might be our first one.
That might be our first MASH reference.
We need to do as many references as possible.
Yeah, we'll have to keep an eye out for a Star Trek reference, though. We haven't had one of those yet today.
Well, now we have. Now we've got it. You just made one. So there you go.
Is that in and of itself a Star Trek reference?
It's kind of a meta reference.
It's not a
direct reference to Star Trek. Well, I'm sure we'll come up with something before the end of the episode.
Yeah, there's one in my notes, but it would spoil something, so I'll tell you guys later.
Okay. Oh, well, now our audience is going to be sitting on the edges of their seats wondering, what is it that Joseph has spotted here? That
we can only hope. We need those 47 people to come back next week.
So as someone who hasn't read this before, where do you think we're going with this stuff? Now, I know you've heard a lot of things from me and Dan, but having gotten to the university, having gone outside and come back in, what are you expecting to see here?
Well, I think we chatted a bit about this. So, you know, I'm, you know, kind of focused on the development of psychohistory. I think Asimov is hinting at the fact that we're going to have something similar to the, I referred to the leading coefficient test, which basically is a thing where you can, you know, if you're looking at big values of X, you have a polynomial, you really only need to pay attention to the first term because all of the other terms are fiddling small change. I think he's hinting that's going to be the secret to psychohistory eventually.
So when you say that, I mean, what do you really mean by, like, what would the first term effectively be?
Okay. You mean in the context of psychohistory?
Or right. So like if you're saying, well, it's a polynomial where the first term dominates and the rest can sort of be thrown away, like what, I'm just interested in how would that play out in the analysis of psychohistory? Well,
you would think it would have to be these, you know, these big events that everybody's focusing on are ultimately, I think, going to turn out to be the important ones in psychohistory. And I mean, there was talk in Foundation that would support that. You know, in the beginning, I don't remember the exact, you know, the exact wording, but when Harry's talking about how psychohistory works, it's, you either have to have a big event or you have to have a huge movement, or you have to have a lot of time, because otherwise the high psychohistoric factors can't build up.
I mean, it's interesting because I think the whole point of, not the whole point, but a point of the meteorological analogy is that while you would think that you could do that with the weather, the big things would really matter the most and the rest would be ignored. That's what turns out to be wrong.
Right.
That's what chaos theory tells you is wrong, is that actually the whole thing is extremely sensitive to a lot of initial conditions that may be things that we can't even measure properly. And that's why the weather is so difficult to predict, because we can't measure the initial conditions to a fine enough level. It may actually be physically impossible, or it may just be extremely difficult. We don't really know which one it is, but I mean, that from a purely technical standpoint, I find that very interesting.
Yeah. Well, it might be, I'm not sure. Cause we didn't really, I wish we'd had a bigger conversation about the weather.
Right.
But it also seems to me that initial observation about the initial conditions just being tweaked led to completely different outcomes in the model. I'm not sure where that is temporally with respect to where Asimov's writing. Had that happened yet? Had that been out there? I mean, certainly chaos and fractals were starting to be a big deal, like in the early 90s.
So, I mean, I was in college in the early 80s, and I know that like Mandelbrot was already talking about fractals. All of that stuff, it was becoming popular. I remember writing a little program on a very kind of rudimentary graphics package that actually drew those very interesting fractals, you know, certain sectors of the complex plane. And I remember Scientific American doing a bunch of stories about it. So that was already in the early 80s. It was becoming popular science. And I think the studies of the weather had already been done. I think that the National Weather Service had already had its epiphany about how trying to get more, they were trying to tighten down their predictions of the weather. And they found that their predictions were actually getting worse and worse as they were buying these supercomputers. As they were trying to do finer and finer measures of the weather, they were getting worse and worse predictions. And that's when all of that came to a head. So I think by 1988, somebody like Asimov would have already been pretty well versed in that. And I agree that this idea that he went to the weather, which seems like the perfect analogy for psychohistory, and then there was no payoff. And I kind of had the feeling that he had the idea to do that, you know, to really get into the weather and how it was analogous to psychohistory. And then he kind of just dropped it.
Yeah, well, I think
he changed his mind.
Well, I mean, one of the things that we know from the trilogy is that you know, cycle history in universe works, even if we have all that those problems with weather prediction, if we're going to presuppose. I mean, that this is, you know, when we talked about, do I think that something like psychohistory could really work the way that we see it? I think no, because of those, you know, because of that chaos theory stuff in universe, it has to work. You have to, you know, if you're going to justify it to people who know these things, you're going to have to explain that away.
I mean, I don't want to make this whole podcast about meteorology, but is it not the case that now, with a better understanding of complexity and chaos theory, that weather predictions have begun to improve quite a bit? And that's directly because of a better understanding of chaos theory.
Well, that's an excellent point, because they have. You're absolutely right.
So maybe, you know, maybe psychohistory gets the same jolt.
Maybe. Because my phone will tell me, yeah, no, it's going to start snowing at 11:02.
So you guys are both, I wanted to ask you this, you guys are both in fairly northern climes. I mean, I'm in Connecticut, and it's freaking cold here right now. Super cold. So Dan, you're in Alberta.
Indeed.
It must be like a fridge up there. I mean,
Well, it's not bad right now. It's back up above freezing.
Right. Really? It's much colder here.
Celsius. A couple of weeks ago, it was luxury. Terrible. It was, we were down at like 35 below, but so that's broken.
Okay.
The thing about the, the disappointment of the theoretical payoff here, I'm kind of wondering if what would have made it interesting as a kind of theoretical math heavy discussion of different forms of chaotic systems, if that's not at odds with what he wants to do narratively, and just giving us a kind of exciting story, a seat of your pants story, it seems to me like the best way Harry could have learned about the possibilities of complex systems for his designing psychohistory would be to meet the lead meteorologist in his office and go over some papers and look at the math. Whatever they're doing up topside of like fiddling with instruments, it might be fun for him to go on a day trip and see what it's like up there, but it doesn't seem like it would help him with the math much. But of course, it's necessary to actually have this scare of the whatever this plane is that he thinks is looking for him, and then he gets lost and he gets this case of exposure, which is never seen on Drantor and all that. So like what makes for the exciting story is in this case, cutting off any kind of discussion of the nature of complexity.
So I actually have a response to that, which I think is that it's a constant theme in Asimov. And I just read for fun, The Caves of Steel and The Naked Sun. Which are the original Lige Bailey and Daniil Oliva stories. And there's a point where Lige goes to this spine called Solaria, where the people are very isolated. Nobody ever sees other people in person if they can avoid it.
Yeah, it's 2020 all over again.
Right. And Lige insists on seeing people in person, not just viewing them tri-dimensionally, which they have that technology pretty well developed. They've got their Zoom calls pretty well developed up there in Solaria. But Lige wants to see them in person because he feels like there's something that you get. He's a detective, and he feels like when you see people in person, there's some extra thing that you get that you're not going to get if you just do it over the phone. And I think you see this over and over and over again in Asimov stories, in iRobot stories. You know, monitoring the robots through cameras isn't good enough. You have to get down there where they are and see what's going on when they're screwing up. And then you understand the problem. And Lige can't solve the case until he is there seeing people in person. And Harry wants to get out there and see the meteorology in person. And in future chapters, he's going to want to go from place to place. And again, just getting a description of it or just, you know, hearing about it, he needs to see the people. He needs to get in there and get his hands dirty. And then some intuitive process is going to take over and he's going to develop. So it's not about the math. It's about that hands-on experience that Asimov continually says people need to have.
Interesting. Yeah, I can see that.
I can see that. But also, I wonder if even though Asimov is famous for long intellectual conversations without no action, poring over a bunch of academic papers is just a bridge too far for him.
Doesn't make a good novel. Yeah, I guess they say that every equation that you put in your popular science book cuts your audience in half. I'm sure every scene of two scientists poring over a paper cuts your audience by 90%.
Well, the TV show could have just adapted this chapter as an episode. Like, if they wanted action,
that's right.
No talking here.
Just, no explosion.
Just have explosions. Jared Harris sort of shivering on a roof somewhere.
Makes sense. Yeah. I can't help but think that while Asimov may have been sensitive to what publishers wanted, again, I just can't see publishers telling him, you can't do it this way. You got to do it some other way. Like he's going to say, look, it's a Foundation story, go sell it. And I'm pretty sure that Foundation's Edge and Foundation and Earth were big bestsellers. I'm not sure that the prequels were as big, but I bet they were. I bet they were at the time. There was just a built-in audience.
Might have been big, but not quite that big.
Yeah, I think that Foundation's Edge might have been the biggest just because it had been so long since there was a Foundation story and the fans just went bananas for it. Maybe the prequels, not so much.
Yeah, I think that was like at the top of the bestseller list for a while, wasn't it?
Oh, I think Foundation's Edge was the number one on the New York Times. And I think Foundation and Earth was too, but it may not have been as big. And I don't remember how big the sequels were, to be honest. I know that one of our first guest, Cora Bullert, said that Prelude to Foundation was the first Foundation story she read. And she loved it so much that that's why she read the rest of them. And okay.
Yeah, that is very interesting.
So I have another question. If you guys, this might be a kind of Asimov trivia you guys may have heard or something, but we have a kind of very parallel story with the opening chapter of the Foundation, right? When Galdornik goes up to the roof of Trantor and gets in trouble with a spy. And this is sort of reenacting what we now learn was Harry's trip to the roof to get in trouble. So was Asimov afraid of heights or something? Did he go up to the top of the Empire State Building and had a really traumatic experience up there?
Well, he was afraid of flying.
That's true.
I don't know if that correlates with a fear of heights necessarily.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, there may have been some, maybe not completely conscious thought that he should recapitulate what we'd already seen in Foundation. I mean, there was certainly the arrest of Harry at the beginning of Foundation and the similar arrest of Harry at the beginning of this. He certainly doesn't keep going that way though. From here, we're not going to follow the Foundation stories.
That's true.
So I don't know. He might've.
It's just an odd parallelism, which I couldn't explain why.
I mean, when you look at the scene with the gravitic lift where, Cheddar just sort of jumps in and Harry is very reluctant to, he does show some signs of at least some nervousness about heights. Yeah, maybe. I mean, I think Asimov was, when you look at this book and Forward the Foundation, there's certainly been a lot of people who've said that they feel like Asimov was tying up loose ends because he knew he was dying. Mm-hmm. Certainly by the time he wrote Forward the Foundation, I mean, he knew he was dying.
Yeah.
And it's actually, I mean, we'll get to it when we get to it, but it's actually not a very cheerful book. Mm-hmm. And, Harry's old age is not particularly cheerful. And it really does feel like Asimov kind of maybe being a little bitter and just kind of like going, well, things are coming to an end here. And, as the Empire is winding down, so is Asimov. Mm-hmm. Less so here, though, in Prelude, where I think he's world building. I think he's having a little bit of fun with Harry and his life and almost certainly Harry is an Asimov stand-in. He's just kind of fantasizing himself about developing psychohistory and doing the things that Harry's doing. It's how I feel. I mean, do you get that? I see some nodding. Do you get that impression that he's
that makes sense. Although I'm not sure to what because Asimov had a shot at an academic career and he chose to be a generalist writer instead. So maybe it was, maybe he was thinking back on you know, missed opportunity. I don't know, but it would make sense. I think there are clear signs that Harry is an Asimov stand-in.
I think it works best for Forward, especially like the end of Forward, the Foundation. You know, in the original stories, Asimov was a young man writing about a very old man. Mm-hmm. Now we have Asimov as an old man writing about a young man.
True.
But in Forward, you know, Harry catches up. And so they're finally at the same place, and it does have that kind of, it feels weird to talk about Asimov as an elegiac writer, but it does have that kind of feeling to it in Forward, the Foundation. So here it might be there. It's not heavy-handed though, if so.
Yeah. I suspect that'll be much more palpable, and I haven't read Prelude either, but I suspect it'll be very forward. Forward. Yeah. Sorry. You're right. It'll be much more palpable then. Because I mean, at that point, I do think he knew he was dying. And so this is, you know, he's probably thinking, this is the last time I'm going to write about Harry. This is the last time I'm going to write about Daniel.
Yeah.
And, you know, those things, you know, just are going to naturally turn out bittersweet.
Yeah. I wonder sometimes about, you know, the characters like Harry, who always, Harry, in Prelude particularly, I really don't like him very much. He's very arrogant and aggressive, and you know, he doesn't suffer fools, certainly. And I again to sort of spoil things, sort of to go beyond where we're reading now, I had the same feeling about Golan Trevize in the sequels. Mm. That he was also very, you know, just very arrogant, and
that was the councilman, right?
Well, he's the main character.
Yeah.
And I realize we're not going to be talking about Golan Trevize for a long time, but I felt like Golan Trevize was also an Asimov stand-in. And I'm just wondering why Asimov would write these obnoxious characters as stand-ins for himself. Maybe I'm overthinking it too much. I don't know.
Well, but maybe not, because I mean, it's, you know, you look at stuff like the Clark Asimov Treaty, for example, that's very arrogant. I'm the best science writer and you're the best science fiction writer, and right, we're going to give each other credit. But he also affected, I mean, and you can see this in a lot of his nonfiction writing, when he's inserting himself sort of in as a character, you know, there's, as opposed to self-effacing humor, this is self-aggrandizing humor. You know, like that bit that we talked about in the, from the intro to the Hugo winners. You know, I think he does a lot of that over the course of his career.
Yeah, but I just feel like that's, it's still self-effacing, but in a self-aggrandizing way. Like, he's overdoing it so much,
right,
that it just comes across as funny, because it's so over the top.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's tricky. I think if you try to do that, people don't get it.
Well, of course. But then, you know, but Asimov doesn't care, because you know, he's so arrogant about it. Mm-hmm. I don't know. It just always struck me that way. Like, why isn't there a likable character in these stories? Like, when I look at Foundation, I mean, I like Salvar Hardin. Yeah, he's still arrogant, but he's likable.
Yeah.
And there's characters in most of the stories that you like. And, you know, whatever else I think about the prequels and the sequels, I find it very difficult to find characters that I like and want to identify with. And I've always wondered about that. Like, why isn't there a likable character? And I don't know the answer. I don't really have a theory.
On that score, let me ask you, do you dislike Doors? We haven't talked much about Doors. This is our introduction to her. What are your feelings about her?
I don't dislike Doors, but I find her entire existence to be in reference to Harry.
Yeah. Yeah.
And when I think about the sequels, what was the name of the female character in the sequels who she becomes the love interest for Pellerat?
I can't remember her name. The Gaia girl.
The Gaia. I didn't like her. Was her, yeah, the Sunshine or something? I can't remember. Oh man,
I think he was writing in the 60s.
I didn't like her very much, but that's the thing with Doors, is that I don't get much of an independent existence for Dors outside of what she's doing for Harry.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because I mean that's the other we've touched on the updated races, racial context. We should probably talk a bit, because I mean here we have a female character.
Yeah,
I guess we have two, because we have Dors and we have Claudia.
Yeah, although we don't see much of her.
We don't see much of her.
Clausia. But with Dors, we see Harry kind of give her the once over. Mm-hmm. We look her up and down, and she does kind of challenge him on that, which is nice to see. We are going to see increasingly cringy attempts by Harry to flirt with her. Which
I think they've already started.
Yes, they have started, and they're gonna get worse.
Oh, I'm just thinking of that one line that I think it comes up next week.
Something about the bet.
Oh no. That bet. That's we'll save that for next week.
Okay. Right? Okay, we'll save that. Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah, that was
like
bad.
That was the word. That was that, like, I read that and it was just like the heavy, most heavy-handed, terrible kind of lounge lizard type thing to say. I was like,
you sued Harry.
Yeah. I mean, he is not treating her with respect.
No.
Right? He likes her. He's like, he kind of has an appreciation for her status as a professor of history, but it's framed in the sense of like, how did a hot young thing like you get to be so smart? Yeah. Like, it's just terrible.
Yeah.
Well, and she has a kind of randy, maybe is a word for it, a wicked sense of humor that she...
She does or he does?
To some degree, both.
I mean, she doesn't encourage him. She discourages him, but she discourages him in a way that's still kind of flirty, if that makes sense. Yeah. She does not say, Harry, I'm sorry. I'm here to help you, but this is completely inappropriate and stop it. Like she never puts the brakes on like that. And that's kind of what I want to see her do.
Well, we know that Asimov personally
kind
of felt entitled to flirt that way with women.
Yeah.
And did not expect them to take it badly. And so he's kind of illustrating to us, I think, how he thinks those relationships go.
You're right.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think that's the reason for this, the way she's written this way.
Yeah. I mean, is it a wish fulfillment kind of thing? Like, some of the female characters in Heinlein who, when you're a teenager, you think are great. Mm-hmm. And when you reread them, when you're, in your 50s, they just seem like kind of weirdly problematic. Like they're, teenage boy wish fulfillment kind of thing. At some point in my head, I was trying to think of similarities between Dors and Wyoming Knot from The Moon is a Harsh Mistress.
Okay.
I mean, they're not a lot of parallels, but I mean, maybe at the core there is that sort of a parallel. So it's sort of a, for lack of a better word, an immature thought of what an equal woman, and the people in listening to the podcast can't see, I just made air quotes, might look like. Although by 1980, you should have a 1988, you should have a pretty good idea of that.
I mean, I actually think it's kind of sad that here he was pretty obviously trying to update the story for modern times, and this was what he thought that meant. Mm-hmm. And he just missed. I mean, it just and you just have to imagine that he was missing it in real life too.
Oh, undoubtedly, yeah.
Well, we know he was, because he wrote about it. He wrote very unapologetically about his attitude.
Yeah, that's true. And I mean, it's annoying. We get so few female characters from Asimov, and he, Dors makes a big deal about not liking math, which is,
although
from my perspective, particularly annoying.
She's very athletic, and She's going to turn out to be very good with knives. Oh. Yeah. Well, we'll talk more about that. That relationship's going to develop over time. They are going to be together for the rest of this book and well into the next one. And so so we're going to have plenty of time to talk about that relationship.
Yeah. On the potential sexism stuff, there was a passage that I kind of noted from Clausia. While Harry is wandering around on the upper side, he's bending over and he's picking up some of the, some of the schmutz that's what I was trying that's on the domes.
Yeah.
And then there's this passage. Clausia had come up to him. She noticed what he was doing and said, with the air of a housewife caught in an embarrassing negligence, "We do sweep hereabouts for the sake of the instruments. It's much worse most places in the upper side, but it really doesn't matter. It makes for insulation, you know." But the with an air of a housewife who had been caught in negligence.
Well,
yeah, that's good. I didn't pick up on that when I read it, but you're right. That's not good.
Yeah, I mean it's better in a lot of ways, but it's still not good.
Yeah.
Although I will say one thing again about what we're going to read is that there's going to be an incident in which Harry believes that his masculine charms are getting him somewhere, and he's really going to be wrong, and it's going to be embarrassing, not just from a cringeworthy standpoint from the reader, but Harry's actually deluding himself and pays a price for it. So at least Asimov gives us that. Although, again, that whole incident is not the most fun incident ever. So you've got something to look forward to, Joseph, as
do
the rest of our listeners. I mean, I don't want to go too far overboard on this and say that it's everything about the story, but boy, it's there, and you just think, man, you had an opportunity to like do something better here, and boy, did you not succeed.
Yeah. If he'd started here in 1941 or 42 and made a similar jump, maybe we would have really had something.
Yeah. Oh, well. Well, I mean, I think we've pretty much driven this thing into the ground for this week. Any last thoughts before we get back and start reading about Harry's journeys across Trantor? Dan, anything? Any moments of levity you haven't brought up?
I'm levitied out. Like this, this is inherently funnier than the TV show, not because it's trying to be funny, but because it's silly. I mean, there's just, it's crazy. And like, my God, next week when we arrive at Mycogen, I'm just, my head's going to be blowing up, guys, because it's one of the most absurd locales in Asimov. So I'm just looking forward to that.
Is it more or less absurd than a Trantorian fashion?
It's more absurd because there's more of it.
Yeah.
And we'll save that. And then Dahl is actually not that much better, which is the next next stop after that. I mean, all the men wear these big, thick porn stashes in Dahl. All the men. Well, we'll get into that, how Asimov trades in stereotypes and how that actually contributes quite a bit to the development of second history. Mm-hmm. But we can leave that for next time. All right, then. We will be back in 2 weeks with more of Prelude to Foundation. We'll really get into Harry's journey around Trantor, and we will follow him with our critical eyes.
Well, that brings this week's episode to a close. Thanks for listening. If you enjoyed the podcast, subscribe and give us a like and a positive review on your favorite platform.
You can also visit our website at starsendpodcast.wordpress.com, where there's always additional content. Our music, used by a Creative Commons license, is It Is Coming by Alex Mason.
Also, follow us on Twitter, @StarsEndPodcast. Goodbye for now from the galactic capital of Trantor, This is where the stars end.